So yesterday we saw the Torah code, okay? And today we keep talking about this beautiful model. Okay, so the Torah code part 2. So I don't know if you know the book on statistical mechanics by Nigel Goldenfeld, which is a very, very beautiful book. And Nigel Goldenfeld is one of the persons that understands statistical mechanics at the deepest. And he has this sentence about the Ising model that I like very much. It says that the Ising model is the Drosophila of statistical mechanics. So as you know, the Drosophila is just the fruit fly. And it is the first organism whose DNA was sequenced. And it has a very simple DNA. And you can sequence it very easily, and you can knock off genes very easily. So you can do on the Drosophila all you want to understand DNA without having, you know, but it's the simplest possible accessible DNA that you can play with. And so the metaphor is that although the Ising model is very simple, only contains variables that have only two values, but it contains all the basic ingredients to understand phase transitions, critical phenomena, the concept of phase, etc. Similarly, the Torah code is the simplest example, is the Drosophila for exotic quantum phases, like topologically ordered phases. So as we saw yesterday, we can generalize the Torah code to some model that features any emergent discrete quantum lattice gauge theory. But they do not contain, I mean, all the basic ingredients that we like are already in the Torah code. So we like it very much because of this reason. So again, so let me draw a big square lattice with periodic boundary conditions. Periodic boundary conditions. And we have spins on the edges. Okay? Our Hilbert space is the total, is the Hilbert space of the spins. So it's C2 tensor it as many spins that we have, that is 2L square, where this is an L times L square lattice. Okay? So we do not have any gauge structure imposed from at the beginning. Every spin configuration is a different state. And then we define two operators, A, N, that is the product of sigma x on the links that come out from N. And I will draw it in red here. So this is the site N. You consider all these spins that come out from N, and you operate with sigma x. So this operator flips all the spins that are around here, flips in the z basis, of course, right? And then we have the Plaquette operator, that is this one, in green. So B, P is the product of all the spins that belong to the Plaquette of sigma z. As we saw many times now, these two operators always commute. And the Hamiltonian of the Torah code is just the sum over all these operators with couplings minus u and minus j. Okay. And we saw that this model features a four-fold degeneracy. Okay, so the degeneracy is 4 to the g, g being the genus of the surface on which we embed our lattice, and it is robust, meaning that if I try to split the different levels, the splitting goes like e to the minus l over xi, and xi is the gap, it's the inverse gap. So well, xi to the minus 1 is the inverse gap that, as we saw, is 4j. Okay? So the picture is that we have these four states on a torus, a gap that is 4j. Now we have the excited states obtained by changing the eigenvalue, so the j states. And then we have up here the u states. And this is because I've chosen u much larger than j. And so these excitations are localized, right? And they come in pairs. They are localized here because I am frustrating this object, or here, and so on and so forth. Okay. The last thing we saw yesterday was that the ground state of this theory, so at least one of the ground states, right? Because it's degenerate. So this means that on a torus there is a basis of four states that span the ground state subspace. Okay? So one of the states has this form. Where G is the set of all the possible products of these operators. So by these brackets, I mean the set of all possible products, of all products. Okay? And so how many there are? There are 2 to the L square minus 1, because remember, the product of all of them is fixed because of the periodic boundary conditions. So we have L square minus 1 independent ones. Each of them can only appear once because the square is 1. So there are 2 to the L square minus 1 of them. And we saw that these objects, so each of these G, so G belonging to big G, which is a product of A operators, as an interpretation, and this, so let me draw it here again. This interpretation is that if I draw a closed contractible loop on the lattice, on the dual lattice, okay? So it's a string joining the centers of the plaquettes, and I operate with sigma x on all the spins that are crossed by this loop, okay? So you can see that this object is inside here. This object is the product of star operators. In fact, it's the product of all the star operators that are inside the loop. So in this case, these 5 here. And you see why? Because every time I multiply two neighboring star operators, the common edge becomes 1, because sigma x times sigma x becomes 1. And you are left only with the contour. Okay. So this is a G. This is some G. Yeah?
Something that wasn't clear for me last time, when we write this from state like this, we never said anything about the Wilson numbers, right? I mean,
yeah. So give me 2 minutes.
Okay.
Give me 2 minutes.
I just had a question about, with reference to the boundary condition. So you said that here we reduce one degree of freedom because of the fact that we've got these boundary conditions. But say along the x direction, I did not have periodicity, and along the y direction, I did. So
then you would not have. Then this is not true. You have L squared of them.
So what so you have L squared of them, but you're actually, that's what I'm not sure, because actually with the boundary conditions, you're imposing two constraints, one along the x direction
and one along
the y.
No. In order to have this constraint, you need
both.
You need periodic boundary conditions regardless of the topology of the surface. So on a sphere,
yeah,
it's still like this. It's not like there is one direction or two directions. On a surface with genus 2, you still have this direction. Constraint. If the surface is closed, so if it's a Riemann surface, the product of all the star operators is 1.
Okay.
Regardless of the topology of this thing. Okay, so it's not about which direction.
So the real constraint is.
Okay, and yeah. And we have a similar constraint for the B.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. So these are string operators of the X type. Okay? I call them X type because, you see, they carry sigma x. So in general, I can define string operators by just drawing strings on my lattice. So I can draw strings on the dual lattice. And they can be open strings or closed strings. And this one will carry x. OK? So strings I call them string operators of the x type. So it's this operator. Let me call gamma 1, gamma 2. Let me call gamma a path on the dual lattice. And this will be just the product of all the spins that are crossed by gamma of sigma x. Okay? Now, if gamma is closed, then it can be written as a product of A operators. Right? If gamma is closed, then there is a G in G, which means there is a product of A operators such that gamma x is equal to G. Okay? If not. And similarly, I can define strings of the Z type. This time I make them run on the edges of the lattice, like this. Right? Or like this. This one is a closed one. Okay, so gamma z product of all the spins in gamma of sigma z l. All right? So in particular, notice that my operator AN is some gamma. For which one? So I showed you yesterday. It's for this one. So it's because an is one of these objects in here. And similarly, the BP is some gamma z. So for some, let me put some index here to say that it is some appropriate gamma, which is directly this string here that carries z, right? And then, so we have closed strings, open strings, and closed non-contractible strings. Okay, so let me call them W's. So W's of X or Z is the product over one of our non-contractible loops of sigma X or Z. Whereas our non-contractible loops are this one or this one. So they are closed, but they are non-contractible. And they have other two in the other direction. That is this one and this one. Okay? Now, let me put this thing up. Now you see that these W operators, the non-contractible loops, they commute with the Hamiltonian. So do you see that? We already know, because every time it's a Wilson loop, it's a loop. Everything that is closed will have to commute with these two operators. The only operators that do not commute with them are those that contain some open end. Okay? So they commute with the Hamiltonian. You can easily check that something that is closed always crosses twice one of these operators, so it has to commute in any case. So because of this, if psi 0 belongs to the ground state manifold, namely the set of states such that an psi is equal bp psi is equal psi. So if psi 0 belongs to the ground state manifold, then because of this, also w, x or z on psi 0 belongs to the ground state manifold. You agree? So we would like to say that four orthogonal states are, so that my ground state manifold is the span of these four states that are psi zero being that guy over up there, so which is the equal superposition of all the loops acting on the reference state that is all spins up. So you remember by G, what I mean is the operator G acting on some reference state that was all spins up, right? So I'm flipping down all the spins that are crossed by my loop. So psi zero is that guy over there, the equal superposition of all this, of all these loops. And you see that psi zero is topologically trivial in the sense that all the operators in this superposition are contractible. Look, this is not an absolute statement. It is with respect to this reference state. Okay? If I had chosen a different reference state, I would basically be in another basis. Okay? I'm specifying a basis here. So one is psi zero, the other one would be W1x psi 0. So where 1 and 2 we label vertical and horizontal directions of this non-contractible loop. Say zero. Say zero. Okay, so this is my claim. So definitely all these states are in the ground state, right? Because of this. So what is that I didn't show? I didn't show that they are orthogonal. Okay, so let's show it. So this is what we want to do. So these are the two directions. Let me write it on the blackboard. So this is W1x and this is W2x.
So act with W set 1 and W set 2 on the reference state, right?
So WZ1 and WZ2, when I write psi 0 in this way, mm-hmm. So they do nothing. Because I've chosen a reference state that is an eigenstate. So of course you can write it in another basis in which you can write it in the X basis, and then WZ is the one that makes you change. So this is a basis. So it's okay to show, I mean, usually you present a vector space by showing a basis. Then what is important is that none of your statements depends on the basis. But you can present it in a basis. Yeah?
Are we on the restricted Hilbert space here? Are we on the restricted Hilbert space because we're saying AM of psi equal to psi?
That's the condition for being.
No. So that it just means that this is the ground. This is the ground space. Is in the ground state. So you are allowed physically to have other states, but I just want to know what is the ground state. So the ground state is like the ground state of the gauge theory, because it has to enforce the same constraints. Again, at low energy, I cannot tell them apart. So this is the essence of the emergence of the gauge theory.
By choosing a basis, are we sort of breaking some sort of symmetry?
No. I'm doing what you do in linear algebra. I present you a vector space by saying this is the linear span of certain vectors. It's the set of all the linear combinations of four orthogonal states. So, which doesn't mean I'm breaking anything. I'm just describing a vector space in terms of a basis. Then I would be breaking something if some of my statements that I say are physically relevant depend on the basis. But I've not done that yet, and I will not do that.
Okay.
Yeah? So I'm just doing normal linear algebra.
So you haven't made any.
What?
Yeah, so we haven't used any aspect, we haven't expressed any symmetry with really.
So I will prove things in this basis, but you can show or you can change basis and see that everything that I prove in this basis will be true in any other basis. I choose a basis just because it's convenient to do calculations in a basis. Okay, so okay, so exercise, because this takes me 10 minutes. Exercise. No, but do it, because it's fun. Show that this thing must be zero. But it's actually very easy. I mean, so if you do this exercise in the basis of A, B, and W, remember this basis, A1, A L squared, B1, B L squared, W1, W2. In this basis, this statement is very, very, it's almost trivial. It is interesting just to play to prove it in the basis of spins. So you get familiarized a bit with this type of calculations. But in this basis comes out very, very easily. So do it in both. Okay. So yesterday I also showed you that if I have some string, let's say gamma x, that is open. So because it's open, it will have endpoints. And it may have 2 endpoints, 4 endpoints, 6 endpoints. It has an even number of endpoints. Right? It can be a string made like this, not a continuous one, right? So this has 6 endpoints. But let's say, without loss of generality, a string with 2 endpoints, A and B. And I act with this operator, so I'm applying sigma x on all the spins that are crossed by this string. Remember, the x strings run on the dual lattice. And I act with this operator on psi 0. So you remember that this is I showed you yesterday, this is an eigenstate of my Hamiltonian. It's an eigenstate with eigenvalue E0 plus 4u. Okay? So I am creating two excitations at A and B. Each of them has energy plus 2u. Right? Because each of them is flipping the sign of A from minus u to plus u.
So do you mean the Hamiltonian acting on that gives you E0?
Yeah, absolutely. The Hamiltonian acting on this gives me this angle. This gives me. Thank you. Okay, so they are eigenstates. So the whole theory is a string theory. The whole spectrum is we have a soup in the ground state of the superposition of all the possible loops. And so psi 0 is the superposition of all the possible contractible loops. This other one, that let me call it psi 1, is this superposition. But on top of this superposition, I have a global non-contractible loop. Psi 2 is this superposition, the same. And on top of that, I have this non-contractible loop. And psi 3, I have both of them. Okay? And now what are the excited states? Are this soup of a superposition of contractible loops, and on top of that, I create an open string. When I say on top of that, it means that in every branch of this superposition, I have this string. It's a superposition, so it has many branches. In each of them, there is one of these things. Yeah?
So the gamma x is a kind of like the raising and lowering operators.
Yeah, so yesterday we saw that it is the raising and lowering operator of the Z2 group. Yeah. Yesterday, in a general case, we have this L plus, that is the raising operator, and L minus is the lowering operator.
Jason asked that. We can generalize this to linear.
So we then we can also generalize it to continuous groups. And I hope to have the time to do it at some point. So this is an excited state. So it is this state. Yeah.
Are those excited states like well defined? Because it's not obvious to me that if I apply one of these string operators to any of these four states, I will have like equivalent excitation. Right?
No. So I'm not sure I understand the question.
So you have the you have the four different ground states, right? Each of those ground states, I can generate an excitation in this way, right? By acting with these string operators.
Yeah.
But are those excitations like equivalent in some sense? Like for example.
Okay.
Apart from.
So they depend. They depend on the. Okay. So let me say the fancy word first. They depend on the isotopy of gamma. So they depend on A and B. Okay. So if you get another string operator like this, that does the same job in terms of endpoints, this is exactly the same state. It's undistinguishable. And you can see it in either basis. But if I have a string operator that has different endpoints, it's another state with the same energy. So the string itself is invisible, but the endpoints are not. So why the string itself is invisible? If I was acting not on top of this soup, but if I was acting on top of the reference state, I would have different states, right? If I act with different strings. But this soup is the superposition of all the possible loops. So, and what a loop does, so these are loop operators, right? So imagine that I have a string, and I act with this loop. Here it cancels, and I have deformed my string. So each of these loops can deform my string as I want, makes the strings fluctuate. So this is a very quantum state, because it's a huge superposition. It's an exponentially large, because you see G is exponentially large, superposition of states. So the only thing that my loop cannot do is to move these two things. So that's why they are all equivalent when they act on the topologically ordered state. If they acted on some spin configuration, they would be distinguishable. But they act on a soup of fluctuating strings. So they are themselves a fluctuating string because of this reason. And in fact, this brings me to, I will discuss it in a minute, but let me just anticipate that in order to have a phase transition, because right now we are stuck in the toric code, then we want to add some operator and eventually have a phase transition. When this soup is not good enough to make the strings fluctuate enough, so when I can start distinguishing them, I lose the topological order and they go back to some symmetry breaking state. We'll see that later, because first I want to show you a beautiful thing that is one of the things that you have to remember from this series of lectures, is that because of the string theory, we have emergent fermions. And this is amazing, because this theory is all bosonic to start with. Why it's all bosonic? Because we have a local Hilbert space made of local operators that commute at distance, right? How can we have emergent fermionic excitations that have Fermi statistics. Right? This means that when I exchange two fermions, I get a phase that is minus one. And this is a very non-local thing.
One thing. So why are you calling the fermions in here?
Well, I didn't tell you yet.
Okay, yeah, because this for me is
right. Yeah. So these two, very good. Thank you. These two excitations. So these are the excitations of the A operator, and they are called Z2 charges. This is just jargon, okay? And these are called Z2 vortices. It's jargon because what is a charge and what is a vortex doesn't mean the theory is self-dual, so you can exchange the role of X and the role of Z by going in the dual lattice. But so we call them one charges and one vortices. It's useful to talk about. So if you exchange these two, so how do I do that? We'll see it in a minute. But if you exchange these two, your state doesn't acquire any phase. And the same here. So these particles are bosons. And this is not surprising. We are starting with a theory in which everything commutes. But how can we have emergent fermions? Okay. So we can do it because this is a string theory. And you know from the diagonalization of the Ising model that if I put in place some string operators, then I can map my theory in a system of fermions. Because the Jordan-Wigner transformation maps onto fermions. Now we are not doing exactly the same thing. I'm just saying that conceptually, the possibility of having fermions depends on the fact that you must have extended operators. Okay. Okay. So imagine that I have two of them. Okay, so let me give some names. So this is A, B. This is P, Q. So this string will be gamma X, P, Q. And this string will be gamma Z, A, B. Okay? And my initial state is the state with these four excitations. So this means gamma Z A B, gamma X P Q. So this is my initial state. Okay. My input state. Notice that right now it doesn't matter in which order I write these things because they don't touch each other, so they commute. So I can write it in any order. Now, let's say that psi out is what I get when I take my excitation Q and I make it go around B. Okay? So to make it go around B, I have to take this circuit C and operate with the sigma x on it. Because this is what will prolong this string and make me do this loop. Okay. So psi out is my c x on psi in. Right? But c x, okay, but psi in is this. So far, so good, right? Now, this guy and this guy have to commute. They both carry x. So I can put this here. And then I want to take cx and cross it here. But look, now cx and gamma z cross in this point. So you have an anti-commutation, sigma x, sigma z. So I get a minus gamma x pq gamma z ab cx psi 0. But now we use the fact that psi 0 is the ground state, and cx is a loop, contractible loop. So it's a product of A operators. So on psi 0 is psi 0, because this is the ground state. And every time I act with some loop on psi 0, I get again the ground state. So I get minus gamma x pq gamma z ab psi 0, which is minus psi in. What is this? This is the Aronoff-Bohm effect for the Z2 gauge field. The real Aronoff-Bohm effect is for the U1 gauge field in electromagnetism. But this is the Drosophila, so we have everything. In a simpler way, this is the Z2 Aronoff-Bohm effect. And as you can see, this phase is independent of the specific path. I can be very far away and still get this phase. I can deform the path as long as I go around. So it's a topological effect. Yeah?
So it's independent of the path as long as it touches once the string that creates the...
Yeah, but you'll see that in order to get around it, it has to touch it an odd number of times.
Sure. Does it make sense to talk about you create pairs of quasi particles, right, mm-hmm. in A and B. So mm-hmm. Does it make sense to talk about just one of those independently of the other?
So that yes, you can if you consider the infinite string, right? So it means that you forget about the other one. In fact, you can forget about the other one because these strings do not have any tension, right? The energy of this, the energy of this object is 4u, and the energy of this object is 4j independently of the length. So there is no tension. These endpoints may move. When I say may, I hesitate because right now these are exact eigenstates, so they don't move. Because they don't evolve in time. But if I perturb my Hamiltonian a little bit, they start moving around and they're basically free particles.
Another thing, so there's no specification of what is the distance between A and B, right?
Right.
So I begin with a local Hamiltonian, but I can create very non-local quasi particles, right?
No, but the interesting thing is that the quasi-particles, the observables, are localized. They are localized. Right? And also, imagine that you are in a very high excited state, and you think you created these two pairs. They are all of the X type. You actually do not know if you have created them in this way or in this way. From the quantum point of view, they're the same because you have this soup of fluctuating strings at very, it's a bit surprising, but this is how it is. Even if we enforce the local operators in the Hamiltonian, the ground state is the soup of string operators at every length. So, that's why we have topological effects, because the ground state can support them, because it has this very non-local nature, if you wish. But the theory is local, because the Hamiltonian is local, and the Hilbert space is local. Okay? So that's why the topological order is emergent.
So that second diagram there, would that not be a string going from a vertex to a plaquette?
Yeah, so this can be either, right? Let's say that I'm exciting plaquettes.
Okay,
I could excite them in this way.
That's not the same as this example, because in that example, one is vertices and one is
vertices. No. This situation is not this situation.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah?
Sorry, so when you're saying you can create things that are very non-local, I would expect like if I start from some ground state thing and I start heating it up to start seeing some dynamics. Is there nothing to prevent two ends of the string to appear at the opposite ends of my thing, or would I expect when excitations are happening to start at a local thing and then start propagating away from each other?
Wonderful question.
Sorry, I didn't get the question.
The question is, so am I correct in understanding that you are worried that because I can stretch them as far as I want, then they can wrap around the torus?
Well,
no.
That as well. But my point is, like, when I start from the ground state, when there is no string operators that haven't reacted, you're saying when I start adding some temperature, I can start having these excitations happen.
Mm.
Well, I'm saying, do they happen? Like, is it possible for them to be happening at the opposite ends of the thing all of a sudden, or would I expect them to happen locally and then propagate away from
very, very, very good. This depends on the way your system is coupled to the environment. If the system is coupled to the environment in a local way, which is what we expect, then the excitation, the pairs are created close by, and then they can propagate, which takes time, but takes the diffusion time. So you can do the ordinary statistical mechanics. Okay. So this depends on the coupling with the environment. So when you say I add the temperature, the right setting is that there is another quantum system that is your environment that has its own Hamiltonian, and then there is an interaction Hamiltonian that couples the two systems. And then you have to understand what happens in this interaction. And under appropriate conditions, if you trace out your system, you are left with something that is not unitary anymore. It's called the master equation, whose fixed point is the Gibbs state that tells you what is the temperature of the system and contains many excitations, etc., etc. The point is that, though, when you create more than one pair, so at every finite temperature, you create many pairs, right? You may create them. So, you can have them in this way because they can be created locally in this way. But for your state, it's the same as if they were created in this way. Again, the strings are invisible because of the strong quantum fluctuations. They fluctuate. What is physical you can measure are just the endpoints. It's where I pay an energy. Yeah? Who was asking?
I mean, since I'll begin it, in what sense does that string correspond to a particle exchange?
In what sense the string?
In what sense does the addition of that C string correspond to an exchange of particles?
No. Right now, I didn't exchange. I just carried one around the other.
And I don't understand how that corresponds to it being a fermion.
I didn't say that. I just said we have the Aronoff-Bohm effect. So when I carry one around the other, I get a phase. We don't have the fermion yet. Okay, I need one more passage to do that. However, the jargon for this situation is that Z2 charges and Z2 vortices are mutual semions. Mutual semions, which... just means this. When you carry one around the other, you get minus. Yeah.
However, if one considers, for example, two fermions or two bosons, in order to calculate the mutual statistics, one uses this kind of Aronoff-Bohm effect argument, right?
No. We do the exchange statistics.
Sure.
I'll do it right now.
However, exchanging two particles,
mm-hmm.
it's equivalent to taking one particle around the other and calculate the phase that one acquires, right?
No, it's almost like that. It's to do 2 half. Let me do it, okay? Instead of, let me do it on the board.
Exchanging it is like, and so it's 2 halves, right?
It's a 2 half of a loop.
Yeah.
So, but 2 halves of the loop has, okay, exactly.
Oh, and So regarding the quantum system that you said, the environment, so we're assuming that the interaction Hamiltonian, you couple it to the environment in a local sense.
Yeah.
But if we consider our environment to be a large reservoir, that you consider in thermodynamic, that it's really, so in some sense you've all of a sudden exposed it to a globally valid temperature around it. How do the excitations propagate then? Like, is it a huge environment all around it globally?
Yeah, but the toric code is still a macro. So the environment is the universe, okay? So it's huge.
Yeah.
But the toric code is still a thermodynamic extended system. When I say that the fundamental physics is local, this means that the interaction Hamiltonian that couples all the infinite degrees of freedom that are here, but couples each of them locally to each of them here. It doesn't couple them in a way that I have an operator that contains the tensor product of some degrees of freedom here and all of them here. This would be a very non-local operator. So local means what local means is R local. If we say our interactions cannot go farther than R, where R is some small distance on here, that's it. Even if the environment is big, it's the sum of many R local pieces. Okay, so let's see the emergence of fermions. So the trick is to create the bound state of two particles. So this means that I create this one and this one. So let me, so this one, no, I forgot. So this one is on the plaquette. So let me draw it properly. This one is on the star. Okay, and similarly here. Okay, so they're nearby. So imagine that I glue them together. Okay? Imagine that I add some term in the Hamiltonian such that they're together. I pay a big energy if I try to unglue them. I can do that. So when I move them, I have to move them together. Okay? So I can see them as one excitation of energy for u plus 4j. That is localized here. Okay. Now let's exchange them. So this means that I take this thing here, and this thing here, and these other two go here, and go here. Okay. The whole thing is a loop. Okay. All I've done is to exchange them. Well, and when you exchange them, so sorry for once to give you a graphical proof, just for once. But you see that this happens. And now this state, because these two anti-commutes, gets a minus one. So this state, these are two fermions. Because when you exchange them, the whole state gets a minus one. So Z2 gives us already emergent fermions, because all we need is a minus one phase, so Z2 is enough. But if we started from some other discrete group, then we could have statistics that is neither bosonic nor fermionic, but it is anionic, as we say. And if we started with a continuous gauge group, which I don't know when I will have the time to show you, but U1, you would have emergent photons. Yeah.
So this relates to the fact that I have both terms on the toric Hamiltonian, right? So if I want to go to the limit where I recover the set to gauge theory, I wouldn't have this type of excitations, right?
Yeah, you wouldn't.
So somehow the fact of having exotic excitations, it's incongruent with having like a gauge structure?
Yeah, so yes. We'll...
Sorry, I didn't get the question.
What? The question is, in order to have emergent fermions, you must excite also the A degrees of freedom, which means that now we are not in the gauge invariant sector. It doesn't look like the gauge theory anymore.
Yeah.
In this sense, there are Z2 excitations because, yeah, we are outside the gauge structure. Yes?
Okay, and the other thing,
please.
Could you explain how you flip them around again, please?
Okay, so you have to take, you have to act with a string operator, open string operator, that takes this one from here to here.
Mm-hmm.
Then another piece of string operator that starts from here and takes this one here.
Mm-hmm.
And the same for the red one. And you will see that when you nest all of them, there are two of them that cross and that they are anti-commute. So when you want to recover the initial state, you have to do your anti-commutation game just as we did there. And you will see that minus one. Yeah.
So you still understand something. So the surprising thing here is that if I take two of these composite particles, I got a fermion, but if I take them individually and exchange them, I don't get a phase factor that is plus or minus one, right?
If you take only charges and exchange them, you get plus. So they're bosons.
Well, each charge with itself, right? Like
yeah, if you exchange a charge with a charge, it's a boson.
But if I take a charge and vortex, right?
Yeah, but whatever phase you get, so first of all, you don't get anything. But exchanging two particles of a different nature doesn't tell you anything about their statistics.
Okay.
I mean, it's not sufficient to determine their statistics. You really need to see what is the exchange on one for the other. However, it's a theorem that if you have mutual semions, so it's not exactly the exchanges.
It's going around.
Around one, then the bound state is a fermion. The bound state of two semions is a fermion. And there is a very complicated proof in quantum field theory. This is the Drosophila proof for lattice.
So here the gauge group is a billion. If I drop out that, right, then I'll have more intricate kind of statistics, right?
Yeah. You have non-abelian anions.
Okay. And other thing is that here I have, so if I have three types of excitations here, right? I have the vortex charge and the composite, right? Does that, is it like a reflection that I have a four-fold degenerate ground state?
Yeah.
Yeah. So if I have a 4 to the G in a general Riemannian surface, then I'll expect to have 4 to the G different excitation.
No. That's a reflection of the 4.
Of the 4 ones, okay.
Yeah. So the degeneracy is some Q to the G in general. So for the toric code, it's 4 to the G.
Sure.
This number Q has to do with the quantum dimension.
Okay.
It's called quantum dimension of your excitation. So the dimension of a Hilbert space that describes all the excitations in your theory.
So why do you not get two factors of negative one for this?
Why get two? What?
Why do you not get, I mean, because it looks to me like this is, like this diagram is just two copies of this, two loops going around an endpoint. So that would, I would have thought you would get two factors of negative one. Which
no,
would just
you
cancel.
Get one. Just try to do the algebra of it. They only cross once. I mean, my fault that I wanted to give a graphical proof. If you do it with the two strings, really, and you exchange and you'll see that they cross once. But of course, you can just write down all the terms and do it in a more serious way.
One other thing we were just discussing. So we were saying if I start on my donut, on my torus, and I excite two guys, two sigma x's, and I go around and they annihilate on the other side, is that equivalent to multiplying a Wilson loop, or is it not?
Yes.
So you would go to a different ground state?
Yes.
Okay.
So this is the extremely important point that deserves a thorough discussion tomorrow. So what happens at finite temperature? Or what happens when there are perturbations? So tomorrow we will see the quantum phase transition and the finite temperature behavior of the topological order, and what role two concepts that we have briefly encountered will play. One is entanglement, and the other one is memory. The fact that when you have a degenerate ground state, you can encode some kind of information, and you want to understand how long it takes for this information to dissipate and the system to thermalize. So all these things are connected in a very beautiful way, which we'll explore tomorrow.
So with respect to this question, let's say I create a pair of excitations, mm-hmm. right, and somehow I drive them around the torus, and I annihilate them. I don't think it's the same as multiplying by a Wilson loop, right? Because it's not a loop. It's an open string.
No, annihilate means that it closes.
No, because I created the two points.
You create, then you annihilate them, so there are no vortices anymore, right? So you're in the ground state, definitely.
No, wait. Confusing.
You create them.
Yeah,
so you are outside the ground state because there is one A that is minus one and the other one that is minus one. Then what does it mean that you annihilate them? That now they are both plus one.
Okay.
Yeah, this is what he means, annihilate.
More.